get envoys to Warsaw, Kaunas, Helsinki, Kabul, Copenhagen, and Riga. The veteran of the Baltic Fleet Mikhail Raskolnikov was Soviet ambassador to Bulgaria, where the NKVD officer sent to purge the legation implicated everyone from the chauffeur, Kazakov, to the military attaché, Colonel Sukhorikov. Raskolnikov himself refused to return to Russia when recalled in April 1939. He was nevertheless rehabilitated in Khrushchev's time, later restored to the category of traitor. He was more definitively rehabilitated in 1987. This must partly have been due to his particularly fine record in the revolution and the civil war, his total lack of involvement in any opposition, and his death within a few months, September 1939. Even Ehrenberg in his published memoirs mentioned having met him at the time when he was deciding to stay abroad and having sympathized with his position. Raskolnikov wrote an offensive letter to Stalin, which was published in the Emigre Novaya Russia on October 1, 1939 after his death, and also a more moderate statement which appeared in another emigre journal, Pozholdny Novosti, on June 26, 1939. In the latter, he says firmly to Stalin, "You yourself know that Pyatakov did not fly to Oslo, showing that a good deal was known and discussed in party circles." Komsomol. One major organization remained under its original Stalinist leadership, the Komsomol. Kosarev had been sent by Stalin to purge the Leningrad Komsomol after the defeat of Zinoviev at the 14th Party Congress in December 1925. In 1926, the opposition bloc had made a powerful attempt to secure the support of the young and of the students. Most of the Trotskyist protest groups were composed of young intellectuals, who attacked party control over the Komsomol. Half the members of the Leningrad Komsomol committee were expelled. Kosarev had been boldly denounced by Kotalinov, then leading Zinovievite in that body, for tactics of sheer bullying. He went on to practice these in Moscow, becoming a secretary of the Central Committee of the Komsomol in 1927 and its general secretary in 1929. Thenceforward, the organization had been a willing tool of the general secretary, a sort of Stalin gigant. Even this was not adequate, as Stalin held that the very first task of all Komsomol education work was the necessity to seek out and recognize the enemy, who had then to be removed forcibly, by methods of economic pressure, organizational political isolation, and methods of physical destruction. In fact, he wanted the organization to become a youth auxiliary of the NKVD. On July 21, 1937, Kosarev was summoned by Stalin and Yezhov and harangued for an hour and a half about the inadequate role played by the youth organization in vigilance and denunciation. He did his best to satisfy their demands. A trial now took place of some members of the Central Committee of the Komsomol: Lukyanov, secretary of the Moscow Komsomol, Saltanov, editor of Komsomolskaya Pravda, and others. In the Ukraine, the youth leadership had already been purged in January, apparently in connection with Postyshev's offenses. On 22-25 July, the Ukrainian Komsomol Central Committee was simply dissolved. Its counter-revolutionary organization had been headed by its first secretary, S. Andreyev, who was shot in the mass execution of November 27, 1937. At the provincial level, when the Smolensk Komsomol was cleaned up in October 1937, it was charged that fascists, penetrating even into the Central Committee of the Komsomol, had now been exposed. On October 11, 1937, the new local first secretary, Manayev, reported that his predecessors, the enemies of the people Kogan and Prikhodko, had undermined 700 Kralkoz Komsomol organizations. The pedagogical institutes, the Tekluikum, the intermediate schools had been filled with hostile people, as were the pioneer organizations. Local secretary after local secretary was listed as a criminal. Already, from one half to two thirds of the members of committees and secretaries of organizations had been replaced. However, Minayev himself was criticized for giving money for medical treatment to enemies of the people under arrest and for criminal slowness in uprooting enemies. The representative from Moscow said that the bad work of the provincial organization was possibly due to the fact that there were enemies in it yet to be unmasked. The discussion consisted of a new torrent of denunciation. The Vyazma delegate, mentioning in passing that his district had lost five secretaries in the past few years, attacked the current holder of that office as completely corrupt and a polygamist. Although a number of hostile people had been expelled, so far they had only scratched the surface. As to teachers, another delegate claimed that out of 402 in his district, 180 were alien elements. As the denouncers came to the fore, Kosarev found that there were some more enthusiastic than himself. A young woman called Miss Hakova from the Komsomol apparat, put up to it, it was later said, by Malenkov, made an attempt to compromise and destroy the leadership of Kosarev's appointees in the Komsomol organizations in the Chuvash Republic. Kosarev intervened directly, prevented the proposed purge, and removed her. Misakova wrote to Stalin on October 7, 1938. 2 or 3 days later, she was invited to see Shkiryatov, whom Stalin had detailed to examine the case. The whole incident, which had doubtless been arranged beforehand for that purpose, was used to complete the ruin of the last small power group which had gone through the Azov period unscathed. As late as 6 November, a speech of Kosarov's to a ceremonial Komsomol plenum was promptly reported in Pravda. But on 19-22 November, a plenum of the Young Communist Central Committee was held. Stalin, Molotov, and Malenkov attended. Stalin strongly defended Misakova and turned the occasion into a violent attack on the Kosarov leadership. A few days later, the majority of that Central Committee were arrested. Beria in person came for Kosarov, the first time he had done such a thing. This is almost certainly significant, as is the absence of Yazhov's name from the entire investigation. For the police commissar was about to fall. According to one NKVD source, Kosarov was accused of plotting with him. By 1939, Misakova was a secretary of the Komsomol, in which capacity she was able to tell this story, accompanied by references to the Kosarov gang, to the 18th Congress, as a tribute to Stalin's sense of justice. By that time Kosarov, after torture at the hands of the NKVD interrogator Schwartzman, had been shot. The purge of the Kosarov leadership, in its social aspect, has been interpreted as the removal of a genuine, if Stalinist, youth cadre in favor of a new conformity and anti-egalitarianism associated with the sons of the new bureaucracy. As with their seniors, the Komsomol Central Committee was devastated. Of 93 full members elected in 1936, 72 were arrested. Of 35 candidate members, 21 were arrested. 319 of the organization's 385 provincial secretaries were repressed, as were 2,210 of the 2,750 district secretaries. The pre-Kosarov leaders of the Komsomol had naturally fared badly, too. The original first secretary, E. V. Tsetlin, had been expelled from the party as a rightist in 1933 and arrested, but was released and returned to membership, rearrested on April 16, 1937. He was sentenced on June 2, 1937 to 10 years by the military collegium, and to death by the local NKVD Troika at Ivanovo on September 16, 1937. His successor, Zero L. Levkin, was sentenced to death by the military collegium on August 7, 1937. The third, L. A. Shotsky, was sentenced to 5 years by the special board in March 1935, and, as we have seen, to death by the military collegium on January 10, 1937. P. Ismordin, the next, whom we have already met in his later Leningrad career, was shot on February 22, 1939. The fifth, N. P. Chaplin, was repressed and died September 25, 1938. The next, A. I. Milchikov, only served 16 years in labor camp and survived. A last blow at the army. The Far Eastern Army had not been treated quiet as the rest of the forces had. For strategic reasons, it had been organized as something like an independent entity. It was the only great body of troops commanded by a marshal, the tough, competent, and practically experienced Blücher. Blücher, though his name suggests a German origin, was in fact of pure Russian descent. His peasant grandfather had had the name given to him by some whim of his landlord during the days of serfdom. Ironically enough, there was something of the German stance to him. Dark and grizzled, he had a square, bull-like face with a large close-clipped mustache in the Feldwebel manner covering his large upper lip. He was now 48. He had been a worker in a wagon factory and had served a 32-month sentence for leading a strike while still 20 years old. He first came to prominence when, with V. V. Kubashev, he had established an isolated Bolshevik enclave amid a sea of white armies, in the Samara area. In the distinguished Civil War career which followed, he had been one of the first to be given the Order of the Red Banner. Later, under the pseudonym Galen, he had acted as chief military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. He is said, back in the early 1930s, to have opposed collectivization in the Far East on military grounds and, with Voroshilov's support, to have obtained a certain exemption there, and there was also talk of some connection with Sirtsov. While Blücher was still in Moscow in June 1937 in connection with the Tukhachevsky trial, the NKVD struck at his army. His new chief of staff, Sangersky, is said to have become involved, with the party secretary of the Far Eastern Territory, Kutev, in what Stalin felt to be some sort of political intrigue against the leadership. He was now arrested and tortured. Another account has him implicating literally hundreds of officers and in 1938 repudiating his confession and claiming that saboteurs in the NKVD were attempting to weaken the army. Sangarsky is reported as still alive in Irkutsk jail in 1939, full of remorse for having, under torture, given away so many officers as fellow conspirators. He was then facing a further charge conspiracy with Yuzhov to wreck the army. With Sangarsky went the deputy chief of staff, the chief of combat training, and the chief of intelligence. In the autumn of 1937, Ingaunis, commanding the Far Eastern Air Force, was also in the Butyrka, having been severely tortured in the Lefortovo and confessing to espionage. The NKVD non-commissioned officer who tore off his insignia and orders in the Lubyanka remarked, "Well, they certainly handed out medals to all sorts of counter-revolutionary swine." The head of the army's political administration was arrested, too. At the same time, most of the political leadership in the eastern provinces were seized. Even so, as far as the army is concerned, this phase only lasted about 5 weeks, and was not so intense or on such a mass scale as in the other military districts. It ended with Blücher's return to his post. For meanwhile, an even more important consideration had arisen. On 30th of June, some patrol fighting had broken out between Soviet and Japanese troops on the Amur, and on 6th of July the Japanese had seized Bolshoi Island in that stream. In spite of protests, the Russians made no attempt to dislodge them. There is no doubt that this was a probing action by Japanese military elements, who took the view that the local Soviet capacity to fight had been largely paralyzed by the purge. Blücher at once started to repair as far as possible the disorganization that had already set in. Tukhachevsky's execution, followed by the arrests in the Far Eastern Army, had left him deeply depressed. But in the face of the military threat, Stalin made no further move against him for the time being. During the winter, various arrests were carried out. Corps commander Rokossovsky had been beaten senseless and dragged off to prison, together with a number of other officers of his unit. When Rokossovsky came before a court, its president said that it had the evidence of one of his fellow conspirators, Adolf Kazimierovich Yushkevich, who had confessed that he and Rokossovsky had belonged to a counter-revolutionary center and had had certain instructions and tasks. "Can the dead give evidence?" Rokossovsky asked, when he was allowed to comment. "What do you mean, the dead? Well, Adolf Kazimierovich Yushkevich was killed in 1920 at Perekop. I mentioned to the investigator that Yushkevich served in the cavalry group, but I accidentally forgot to mention his loss." Equals. Rokossovsky was merely imprisoned, and was one of those lucky enough to be released when the pressure had died down. Meanwhile, things were to get worse. Corps commander Kakhanin, head of the political administration of the Far Eastern Army, was arrested on February 1, 1938. And at the end of June 1938, when every other part of the army, and of the country, had been dealt with, Meklis arrived in Khabarovsk with a group of new political commissars. At the same time, the sinister Frinovsky steamed in a special train, with a large NKVD staff. The great purge of the Far Eastern Army, of which they had been cheated in 1937, was now at hand. Registered. Meklis and Frinovsky first destroyed their own representatives. Meklis replaced the officers of the political administration, the Gamernik. Bulin gang was later said to have been particularly active in the Far East. Frinovsky arrested and shot the 16 leading NKVD officials of the area. He was balked of one major figure. The Far Eastern NKVD chief was G. Lushkov, who had been deputy head of the secret political department under Molchanov in the days of the Zinoviev trial. One of the few of such a rank still left over from the Agoda regime, he had been so far spared because of his friendly relations with Yuzhov. He had now decided it was time to push his luck no further, and on 13th of June he had slipped across the Manchurian border with a vast amount of intelligence information for the Japanese. Having prepared the police and political striking forces, Stalin's emissaries turned on the army proper. Blücher's new staff and commanders were arrested wholesale. His deputy commander, his new chief of staff, his new air commander, Pumpor, who had served in Spain, and his leading army commander, Lewandowski, recently transferred from the Caucasus, all disappeared. Pumpor was later released, but was rearrested and shot in 1942, but now it was not only a matter of a few seniors. 40% of the commanders up to regimental level, 70% of divisional and corps staffs, and over 80% of the front staff were seized, as NKVD lorries raided the officers' quarters night after night. Blücher was soon standing amidst the shambles of what had been his command. Once again he was reprieved, and for the same reason as before. The Japanese had seen their chance. On July 6, 1938 they launched a probing attack with limited objectives on Lake Hassan. Fortunately, There were still a few competent officers who had survived or been transferred to the area, in particular, Corps Commander Stern, who had recently been chief military advisor in Spain and was now given command of one of the armies into which Blücher's front had been reorganized. He was to have time to fight his battle and report on it to the next party congress and even to be elected to the new Central Committee before he, too, disappeared. After 5 weeks of intermittent fighting, the Far Eastern troops first contained the Japanese and then pressed them back. By 11th of August, the battle was over. A week later, on 18th of August, Blücher was recalled to Moscow. The Stalin air route, pioneered with such panache at the time of the Zinoviev trial, was being put to typical use by the General Secretary. A special pilot, Alexander Golovanov, later to rise to be Chief Marshal of the Soviet Air Force until his removal after Stalin's death in 1953, had been allotted by the NKVD for urgent travel by members of the Central Committee and government. In 1935 and 1936, he had served in the labor camp administration in Siberia. Now he was provided with a special multi-engined aircraft, and in 1937 and 1938 this was used to transport arrested officials from the Far East and elsewhere. He had lately carried most of Blücher's subordinates and their NKVD escorts back to Moscow. But the marshal himself went by train. He was not yet, however, under arrest. At the end of August, he made a report to the Military Soviet of the People's Commissariat of Defense. Criticism was sharp and one-sided. Voroshilov attacked him, while Stalin, who had always defended him previously, remained silent. Later Voroshilov told him that he was not to return to the Far East, but to remain at the disposal of the Military Revolutionary Soviet until a post suitable for a marshal could be found. Meanwhile, he should go on leave to Sochi, the resort in the Caucasus. Blücher telegraphed his wife to return, adding that his health was poor. He put some money aside for her, in case he was arrested. For the chances of this now seemed high. She and the family joined him soon afterwards, together with his brother, Pavel, commander of an Air Force unit in the Far East. By this time, he had learned of the arrest of Army Commander Fedko, Assistant Commissar of Defense, which seems in some way to have been associated with his own. Fedko put up armed resistance and ordered his guard to hold the NKVD men at gunpoint while he telephoned Voroshilov, who told him to yield temporarily. On 22nd of October, on Stalin's personal orders, four men in black civilian suits entered Blücher's place and arrested all the family. Blücher and his wife were taken to the Lefortovo, where Berry had personally conducted the first examinations. He was then continuously interrogated by other NKVD officers working in shifts. The charge was of having been a Japanese spy since 1921, and of having planned to escape to Japan with the help of his Air Force brother, Pavel. This second charge at least was not totally implausible. After all, Lushkov had just done precisely that. The marshal was now told that in addition to the rest of the family, his first wife, Galina, had been arrested in Leningrad. He had taken the pseudonym Galin from her name. Apart from using all these hostages, the NKVD also offered him an inducement. If he confessed, he would get off with a 10-year sentence. However, he refused to sign the protocol. On October 28, 1938, medals were awarded to the heroes of the recent fighting in the Far East, including Stern. The true victor was now undergoing severe torture by his NKVD interrogators. There is no evident reason for the NKVD to have practiced or feigned on this occasion the haste with which the May, June 1937 purge of the Tukhachevsky group had been carried out. And unlike the procedure not only in that case, but even in the July 1938 military executions, we learn from a Soviet publication of the Khrushchev period that Blücher was killed without court or sentence. It was also stated that uninterrupted interrogation broke down the health of this feral man. And we are now told that by 6 November, he had been beaten until unrecognizable and died as the result of inhuman beatings though without signing any confession. Fedko and Kakhanin, his presumed associates, were not to be executed until the following February. His wife, Glafira, spent 7 months in solitary confinement in the Lubyanka, then 8 years in camps, but survived. Their 5-year-old daughter was sent to an NKVD orphanage in Kemerovo, where her mother eventually found her, being the first mother ever to appear there. There have always been rumors that Blücher, or some of the officers round him, had seriously entertained the idea of a revolt. There is no reliable evidence of this, though Lushkov gave information to the Japanese about opposition groupings in Siberia. Much of this was seen, and transmitted back to Moscow, by the Soviet spy Richard Sorge. And whether it was factual or speculative, it seems from the timing that it may have been used against Blücher. The true reasons for proceeding against the marshal seems to have been that he was a comparatively independent-minded soldier, and, as a candidate member of the Central Committee, a politician, in a position of power and influence. His fall and death marked the end of the last tenuous hope of action against Stalin. By the beginning of November, official listings of the military leadership ran Voroshilov, Meklis, Shedenko, Shaposnikov, Badeni, Kulik, Dymashenko. For the first time, the purge operatives ranked before the surviving soldiery. A few days later, the same order of listing contained an even more insulting and symptomatic insertion: Frinovsky, briefly become People's Commissar for the Navy, immediately after Voroshilov. The fall of Yuzhov. It was around the end of October that the first overt moves against Yuzhov took place. Kaganovich and others persuaded Stalin to appoint a secret commission of the Central Committee to report on the NKVD. Its members were Molotov, Beria, Vyshinsky, and Malenkov. It reported in mid-November, in terms hostile to Yuzhov, two secret resolutions of the Central Committee criticized irregularities in investigative methods, and called for recruiting honest people to the security agencies. Over the next few weeks, several of Yuzhov's men were removed from their posts. Finally, on December 8, 1938, it was announced that his rule, at once pettifogging and bloodthirsty, had come to an end. He was replaced as People's Commissar for Internal Affairs by Beria, retaining only his Commissariat of Water Transport. For a time, Beria appeared together with Yuzhov on the platforms and in the formal lists. Yuzhov had by January dropped back to his former correct seniority in these lists, lowest of the candidate members of the Politburo, Khrushchev being absent in Kiev. He is last publicly mentioned on the Presidium for the anniversary of Lenin's death, on 22nd of January. Although not a delegate to the 18th Party Congress, in March, he was present as a member of the outgoing Central Committee. And when the Congress's Senior and Konvent, or informal Council of Elders, met to consider names for the new Central Committee, Yuzhov went forward. There were no objections until Stalin said he thought him unsuitable, since he was involved in a plot with Frinovsky and others to use Stalin's own bodyguard to assassinate him. Yuzhov answered that it had been he who had exposed this plot. But Stalin retorted that this was only to cover himself. Moreover, he had arrested many innocent people while protecting the guilty. Stalin ended by telling those present that in his opinion Yuzhov was unfit to serve on the Central Committee, though it was, of course, up to them to decide. But Yuzhov was only arrested in early April, at the Water Transport Commissariat, where he had chaired the collegium but not taken part in the discussions, keeping silent or making paper airplanes. He is reported as confessing freely, and implicating others as required. He was charged with framing innocent people, with plotting to kill Stalin and seize power comma registered and with being a British spy since the Civil War. But he was not shot until the following year. Frinovsky had remained commissar for the Navy until removed and arrested in March. Otherwise, Yuzhov's leadership group in the NKVD had almost all been purged by the end of 1938. About 150 of his followers were shot. By March 1939, Beria's men were everywhere in power. His own Georgian following held many of the major NKVD posts, in Moscow, Merkulov and Kobolov, in Leningrad, Goglides, in the Maritime Province, Gavishiny, in Belorussia, Zonova. These were what was later to be characterized as the Beria Gang, until they all fell together in 1953. The appointment of Beria is usually taken as a convenient date to mark the end of the Great Purge. Of Beria. That is, of a man whose name, even in official Soviet circles, is now the very embodiment of terror and torture. And yet there is some sense in the convention. Yuzhov's removal was a simple piece of Stalinist expediency. The fact that most of his subordinates were executed under Beria was a simple matter of political mechanics. For apart from Yuzhov himself and his personal nominees, the leading purgers, Stalin's own agents, did not suffer. Shkiryatov, who had acted as Yuzhov's assistant, simply returned to party work, and died, fully honored as head of the Party Control Committee, a year after Stalin's own death, in 1954. Meklis and Vyshinsky also survived into the 1950s. As for Malenkov, he flourished greatly in the years that followed, together with his rival Zhdanov. In fact, throughout the purge, Stalin had largely avoided public responsibility. And now, when the terror had gone as far as it conceivably could, he could profitably sacrifice the man who had overtly carried out his secret orders, the man the party and public then blamed most. It would perhaps be going too far to compare the situation too closely with one common in despotisms, like the Byzantine favorite who instead of being suffered to possess the reward of guilt was soon afterwards circumvented and destroyed by the more powerful villainy of the minister himself, who retained sense and spirit enough to abhor the instrument of his own crimes. Stalin had perhaps no strong liking for Yuzhov, who never figures as one of his boon companions. But it would doubtless be Yazhov's narrow political comprehension, rather than any moral deficiency, that his superior might despise. The comparison is, rather, with the old autocratic tradition of disposing of the executioner who has killed one's rivals and thereby attracted to himself the main hatred of the survivors, a matter, in fact, of a common historical action which the wretched Yazhov had not the wit to foresee. As we have said, by mid-1938 the NKVD itself, at the lower, operational level, had already wished to stop the progress of the purge for obvious reasons. At the rate arrests were going, practically all the urban population would have been implicated within a few months. But it was caught in its own system. It was impossible for it not to arrest a man who had been denounced as an agent of Hitler. And an interrogator who did not demand the names of accomplices from each of his victims would soon himself come under denunciation for lack of vigilance or enthusiasm. By this time, the idea had grown among prisoners that the more denunciations they made the better. Some even held the strange theory that the more people were jailed the sooner it would be realized that all this was nonsense and harmful to the party. My neighbor on the plank bed in the camp at Kalima had once been head of the political department of a railway. He prided himself on having incriminated some 300 people. He said, as I had often heard in prison in Moscow, the worse it is the better it is, like that, it will all be cleared up more quickly. And, in fact, this was of some effect in the railway context, though no doubt elsewhere as well. The Belarusian leaders complained that the NKVD had arrested every second railway official and that the system was near paralysis. Weisberg recounts the arrest in the spring of 1938 of the secretary of the Kharkov Medical Council. A man with an excellent memory, he knew the names of all the doctors in the city and denounced them all, pointing out that he was in an especially good position to have recruited them and that they were in any case largely from hostile social classes. He refused to name any of them as the leader of the plot, claiming that post for himself. The doctor told his cellmates that he had been inspired to take this course by reading about the case of a witch burning in Germany at the time of the Inquisition when a young theologian charged with intelligence with the devil had at once pleaded guilty and named the members of the Inquisition as his accomplices. The interrogators were unable to torture him, as he had confessed, and the case went up to the archbishop, who put an end to the business. A climax of the mass purge came in the first half of 1938, and the following months saw something of a diminution of pressure. Whether this was due solely to a simple loss of momentum at the lower, operational level, or to political pressures being put on Yazhov from above, is not clear. Stalin's discontent with Yazhov certainly began in the early summer, when the plans to bring Beria in must have been laid. But he left Yazhov in office, and veteran prisoners speak of a climax of brutality in September. In October, the number of military collegium sentences actually increased. Even before Yazhov's fall was formalized, a significant case was reported from Omsk, where the regional prosecutor and his assistant were tried for abuse of authority, unjustified arrests, and detention of innocent people in prison, sometimes for as long as 5 months. They were sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. This sentence seems only a partial triumph for justice. A few shootings of NKVD interrogators for extorting false confessions by violence are reported to symbolize the actual end of the Yazhov period. Captain Shiroki, of the Kiev NKVD, was sentenced after having been made head of the Moldavian NKVD. One prison mentions him as a not particularly harsh examining magistrate. Five other Moldavian NKVD men were also shot. There had, indeed, been occasional similar trials before, and speeches throughout the purge period are full of condemnation of unjust persecutions. But this time, the demonstration was clearly intentional. When certain party officials became too free with their criticisms of police methods, though, Stalin pulled them up sharply with the telegram of January 20, 1939, explaining that torture was authorized, see here. At the same time, certain cases which had become more of a nuisance than they were worth were dropped. For example, for the physicist Weisberg, an agitation had been raised in the West to which even very left-wing scientists had subscribed. Moreover, papers in his investigation had been inadequate and muddled. It was now abandoned. Weisberg explains how technical difficulties arose. When it was more or less accepted that the charges against him would be withdrawn, it was found that there were over 20 witnesses who had provided the evidence and it would be necessary to examine them all over again, and by this time they were, of course, scattered in camps throughout the country. The gross result of Beria's assumption of the NKVD was that a proportion of those in prison awaiting trial were released, making a good impression on the populace. Of those already in camp, apart from certain special rehabilitations, like those of some military men in 1940, almost none were freed. An NKVD officer, himself under arrest, predicted this. Some of us will be released just to make it clear there has been a change, the remainder will go off to the camps to serve their sentences just the same. What will be their criterion? Chance. People are always trying to explain things by fixed laws. When you've looked behind the scenes as I have, you know that blind chance rules a man's life in this country of ours. But in the towns and villages of the Soviet Union, the pressure of haphazard mass arrests greatly eased. The country had been broken, and henceforward a limited number of arrests of men who had given some sort of cause for suspicion of disloyalty was sufficient to maintain the habit of submission and silence. In general, Beria consolidated and institutionalized the system. From the Yezhovshchina, he developed, rather than an emergency operation against the people, a permanent method of rule. Stalin and Beria consolidate. The imprisoned Politburo members were not among those fortunate enough to benefit by the fall of Yezhov. While Ushakov and Nikolaev were at work on Ik, their colleague Rodos was submitting Kosir and Chabar to long tortures, receiving detailed instructions from Beria. Rodos was to be described by Khrushchev as a vile person with the brain of a bird and morally completely degenerate. Summoned in 1956 before the Central Committee Presidium, he said, "I was told that Kosir and Chabar were enemies of the people and for this reason, I, as an investigative judge, had to make them confess that they were enemies. I thought I was executing the orders of the party." Khrushchev expressed great indignation at this answer, but all the same it is the only justification he gives for the activities of himself and his surviving colleagues during the same period. On 22 to February 26, 1939, Kosir, Chabar, and others came to trial with another group of figures from politics and the army, who appear to have been called the military, fascist center. Corps Commander Kakhanin was shot on 22nd of February, and Marshal Yegorov on 23rd of February, though we are recently told that Yegorov, reported by Ulrich to Stalin as tried and shot, died under interrogation. On 23rd of February also came the execution of Kosarev, after a trial which lasted for 10 minutes, he had been severely tortured, but had not confessed. The charges included espionage for Poland. Presumably, the remainder of the Komsomol leadership was tried on the same day. On 25th of February the three survivors of the abortive Leningrad center that Zakovsky had mounted in 1937 were shot, B. P. Pozern, P. I. Smorodin, and A. I. Ugarov. So were others, including the chairman of the Uzbek Council of People's Commissars, S. Segizbayev. On 26th of February came the turn of Kosir, Chabar, and Postishev. Kosir had been produced by Yezhov, before the latter's fall, at a confrontation with Petrovsky in the presence of Stalin. Kosir, completely broken, had admitted that he was a Polish spy and, on another account, to terrorism. Postishev had also confessed. Others shot that day include Army Commander Fedko. He had confessed to being a German spy when Beria brought Voroshilov to see him in Lefortovo. Mirzian, too, was now shot, having confessed to being an agent of Bukharin, and implicating all the other Kazakh leaders. Others shot at this time included several of the most prominent NKVD men, such as Boris Berman, sentenced on 22nd of February. Among them was Zakovsky, who had been badly tortured. He is said to have been a British spy. Thus by a certain irony, Zakovsky seems to have perished in the same case as the Leningraders who had been his intended victims. We are told in a recent article in Izvestia that those now sentenced were taken directly to the cellars, and that it was all done in such haste that a man had scarcely been shot when others sentenced to death were coming down the corridor. Equals. Kosir's two surviving brothers, Kazimir and Mikhail, perished too, as did his wife, Elizaveta, put on list 4 and shot, and the wife of one brother is reported attempting suicide on receiving a 10-year sentence. Postishev's oldest son, Valentin, was shot, and his other children were sent to labor camps. His wife, Tamara, was viciously tortured night after night in the Lefortovo, often being returned to her cell bleeding all over her back and unable to walk. She is reported shot. Chabar's wife was also executed. Kosarev's wife and his 17-year-old daughter were sentenced to 10 years, and his father-in-law, the rector of the Trade Academy, was shot. There remained one Politburo figure who, though in bad odor, was not under arrest, Petrovsky. His position had now been extremely difficult for 2 years. Among the Leningraders arrested in 1937 was his elder son, Peter, who had edited the local Leningradskaya Pravda. Petrovsky, candidate member of the Politburo and head of state of the Ukrainian Republic, was unable to get news of him. He met a stone wall of silence. Friends, high officials in the party and state, made several attempts to find out the facts. Finally, they had to give up. The strictest instructions had been given to prevent anyone from discovering what went on behind the walls of the Lubyanka. Young Petrovsky never emerged alive. Dilda, another son, Corps Commander L.G. Petrovsky, was expelled from the party and army, but though arrested was later released. Meanwhile, in July 1937, when various illegalities were being perpetrated in the Ukraine without the consent of the leadership, Petrovsky had written to Kalinin, his titular superior, complaining that the principles of party democracy were being overborne. This is consistent with his failure to join in the denunciations at the Ukrainian plenum that month. He had, it is said, become critical of the personality cult. Equals but on February 4, 1938 he was awarded the Order of Lenin for his 60th birthday. And he remained theoretically chairman of the Ukrainian Supreme Soviet throughout the fall of all his colleagues. After a conversation with Stalin which he described as short and painful, he was removed, in June 1938, from his Ukrainian posts. This was, it was pointed out in Khrushchev's time, done unconstitutionally. At the 7th of November parade, he did not appear with the leadership, and was henceforth not to be named in the listings. A political case was concocted against Petrovsky in the usual way. The caretaker of a villa near Kiev which had been used by the Ukrainian leaders made, after beatings, a confession incriminating him. Petrovsky's secretary is also reported under arrest in the same circumstances. Tilda, a brother of Petrovsky, is reported in the Butyrka in 1938. In March 1939, during the 18th Congress, charges were made as a result of which he was not elected to the new Central Committee. He was accused of friendship with K.V. Suhomlin, Ukrainian Politburo member since exposed as a Japanese spy, of having failed to report his knowledge of S.V. Kosyura's connections with foreign counter-revolutionary organizations, and of having, presumably in the 1920s, opposed Kaganovich's nomination as Ukrainian First Secretary. In fact, there is no doubt that a case against him, long prepared, was now to be launched. But Stalin held his hand. Petrovsky was relieved of his membership in the Presidium of a Supreme Soviet, his last and titular appointment, on May 31, 1939 in a public fashion and with the title Comrade, an indication that his name was not yet unsayable. He had been unable to get any employment for some months, living on whatever his wife could earn. Finally, in June 1939, he was allowed to take up the post of Assistant Director of the Museum of the Revolution, offered him by another former Duma member, Fedor Samoylov, which he held until Stalin's death. His name disappeared from reference books, and most foreigners imagined that he had been executed. But it continued to appear in one single list, that of former Bolshevik members of the Duma. Stalin shot 127. None of them, the others, all third-rate figures, survived to die natural deaths. Since I first noted this, an account has appeared from the Petrovsky family archives, in which Stalin shouts at Petrovsky that his former membership in the Duma would not save him. But it did, or something did. Petrovsky survived Stalin, only dying in 1958. In fact, he was the first figure to be restored to favor after Stalin's death. A decree of April 28, 1953 awarded him the Order of the Red Banner of Labor in connection with his 75th birthday and his services to the Soviet state. His real birthday was on 4th of February, at a time when Stalin was still alive, when nothing had been said of it. So the incident was quite plainly a conscious political demonstration, made during Beria's attack on the Stalin heritage. During the purge period, Petrovsky had certainly suffered, if less than many. Yet it would perhaps not be inappropriate to recall that, when Commissar of Internal Affairs in 1918, he had ordered the unconditional shooting of all engaged in any sort of White Guard activity. At the same time as the February 1939 executions came an event which caused little stir. One last ex-oppositionist remained. Krupskaya had been able to do little during these years, though Stalin had allowed her to save from death one or two figures like I.D. Chigorin, arrested in 1937, even though, his health ruined and not fully rehabilitated, he had to live in poverty thereafter. Although still a member of the Central Committee, Krupskaya had only the minor job of Assistant People's Commissar for Education, and even there was deprived of the possibility of influencing decisions in education. Equals. She died on 28th of February, and Stalin himself carried the urn with her ashes at her funeral. Nadezhda Krupskaya will no more protect the innocent, the dying, those executed like rats. Even to the slight extent that she had done so. The very next day, the head of the Commissariat of Education's publishing house ordered his subordinates, don't print another word about Krupskaya. A part of her works was sent off to the special store sections of libraries, part was buried in oblivion and not republished. One Soviet account has it that she was poisoned, but others deny it. The Zvyfth Congress. The 18th Party Congress on 10 to March 21, 1939, which saw Yazhov's fall, was the scene of the complete consolidation of all Stalin had striven for since that of 1934. The changes were extraordinary. Of the 1,966 delegates to the previous Congress, 1,108 had been arrested for counter-revolutionary crimes. Even of the residue lucky enough to survive, only 59 now appeared as delegates. Of these, 24 were old Central Committee members, leaving only 35 of the 1,827 rank-and-file delegates of 5 years previously, less than 2%. This is an indication of how literally we may take the thesis that Stalin created an entirely new party in this period. The list of the Central Committee membership now elected shows that 55 of the 71 who had been full members in 1934 had gone, and 60 of the 68 candidate members. Of the 115 names no longer appearing, which included some natural and some possibly natural deaths, 98 had been shot, as Khrushchev later stated in the 1956 secret speech. The most recent official account gives the total sooner or later killed by an executioner, by a murderer, Kirov, or by their own hand is 107. The discrepancy is due to the inclusion or otherwise of suicides, assassinations and so on, and of those shot at a later date, such as Lazovsky. In the new committee one can note the groupings, no longer political factions, as in the pre-Stalin period, but personal followings, which were to contend for Stalin's favor over the next 14 years, and for power thereafter. Zhdanov and his group are well represented, with himself, Sherbakov, Kosygin, and A.A. Kuznetsov as full members, and Popkov and Rodionov as candidate members. The first two were to be the alleged victims of the later doctor's plot, and three of the other four were to be shot in the Leningrad case of 1949-1950. Another group was associated with Malenkov, he and V.M. Andrianov in the Central Committee, Pervukhin, Ponomarenko, Pegov, Devazian, and Malyshev as candidate members, together with Shatalin, Malenkov's closest associate, on the Revision Commission. Beria was better represented still. With himself, Bagirov, and V.N. Rakulov on the Central Committee, and Gavishiani, Goglides, Kobolov, Dekanozov, Arutinov, Bakraji, and Charkvyani as candidate members, plus Zanava on the Revision Commission, we see his control in the secret police and in the political mechanism in the Caucasus. There were four other NKVD representatives, Nikishov, head of Dalstroy, V. Pizarovlyev, Kruglov, and Maslenikov as candidate members, a total of 10 secret police on the Central Committee, by far the highest number yet. Khrushchev, too, had his band, four full members of the committee from his own selection in the Ukraine. Stalin's own personal group was also, of course, fully represented, with Meklis, Shkiryatov, Poskrovichev, Shedenko, and Vyshinsky. In the Politburo, the losses had been less great than at the lower level. But they were still remarkable. Kirov had been assassinated, and Kuibyshev had died or been poisoned. Orjonikidze had been either murdered or forced into a suicide which was scarcely different from murder. Rudzitek had been shot 8 months earlier, Kosyrp, Chubar, and Postishev, just before the Congress. Petrovsky had been removed, and was in Moscow, uncertain of his fate and begging for a menial post. Of the four who had been brought in between the Congresses, Khrushchev and Zhdanov were balanced by Ik, in prison awaiting execution, and the doomed Yazhov. Of four of the fallen leaders, it has now been specifically said that they were tortured, Rudzitek, Ik, Kosyrp, and Chubar. On March 22, 1939, four promotions were made into the Politburo, of those who had served Stalin most satisfactorily during the recent period. Zhdanov and Khrushchev were raised to full membership, Beria became a candidate member, as did Shvernik, who after Tomsky's removal in June 1929 had been appointed head of the unions. He had adequately transformed them into organizations for mobilizing and disciplining labor. There is a notable difference in Stalin's treatment of the more senior generation of his supporters on the Politburo and those promoted later. If we take the members of that body who supported him against the oppositions, of the 11 promoted to it up to July 1926, 6 survived right through the purges, 2 were physically destroyed by informal means, Kirov and Orjonikidze, 1 died in doubtful circumstances, Kuibyshev, 1, though removed from his posts, survived until after Stalin's own death, Petrovsky, and only one was tried and shot, Rudzitek. But of the 8 promoted from July 1926 until the end of 1937, only one, Zhdanov, survived. All the others were executed. This distinction should perhaps be interpreted as follows: in the earlier period, it was not a question of Stalin simply nominating rapidly promoted figures from the second rank of the party. He was bound to rely on men who had reached high position to some extent on their reputations, and who in any case were widely enough known to the leading circles of the party and had good enough party records for their presence not to appear absurd on a body still containing distinguished and widely known oppositionists. They were men who, in however minor a way compared with the Trotskys and Bukharins, yet represented a continuity with Lenin's leading cadre. Some of them, like Kaganovich, were eager supporters of the Great Terror. Others, like Molotov, may have had qualms but became enthusiastic accomplices, whether through fear or from other motives. More reluctant figures, like Kalinin, remained useful figureheads. In disposing of them, Stalin inclined to roundabout and concealed methods. But the Ikes and Postishevs carried little more party prestige than the other members of the Central Committee, and they were as readily expendable if they failed to satisfy. The new leadership, Stalinist in every sense, made the Congress a triumphal celebration. At the same time, dissociating themselves from Yedrovism, the most notorious purge operators deplored more strongly than ever the excesses of the purge. Shkiryatov quoted at length an incident of a man in Archangel wrongly removed from his job, arrested, and restored as a result of an appeal to the Central Committee. Zhdanov referred to a man who had written 142 denunciations, all false, and raised a number of cases in which individual party members had been wrongly expelled, including such incidents as one in Tambov province, where the expulsion and wrongful arrest of one man led to the expulsion from the party of his wife and seven other members, and from the Komsomol of 28 young communists, while 10 non-party teachers lost their jobs. Khrushchev's ally Serdyuk expressed horror at a denunciation of a large number of enemies of the people in the party apparatus in Kiev which had turned out on investigation to be signed by someone using a false name, and to be in the handwriting of the head of the cultural section of one of the district committees. Another case, also in Kiev, was of a woman teacher who in 1936 and 1937 had denounced a large number of innocent people, and also obtained by blackmail and threats 5,000 rubles from various organizations and 3 free trips to a resort. Serdyuk explained to the disgusted delegates that her slanders had been written at the dictation of enemies of the people since unmasked, and that she herself had been sentenced to 5 years. Stalin himself summed up, the purge had been accompanied by grave mistakes, indeed more mistakes than might have been expected. Undoubtedly, he went on, we shall have no further need of resorting to the method of mass purges. Nevertheless, the purge of 1933-6 was unavoidable and its results, on the whole, were beneficial. The phrase 1933-6 might have struck the layman a little oddly. The fact is that the expulsions from the party at that time had been constitutionally and publicly authorized, while the later purge had not ever been formalized, and so could be taken as irrelevant. Party executions, in fact, continued. Over the next years, Stalin and Beria wound up most of Yazhov's unfinished business. In July 1939, the prosecutor's sanction for Ike's arrest was at last obtained, to some extent legalizing the position. Ike was presented with the charges against him on October 25, 1939, and wrote to Stalin protesting his innocence, and blaming the frame-up in part on Trotskyites he now took credit for having persecuted in West Siberia. Ushakov and Nikolai III, he added, had utilized the knowledge that my broken ribs have not properly mended and have caused me great pain, as the result of which he had incriminated himself and others. He asked for an end to the vile provocation which wound itself like a snake round many persons, in large measure through my meanness and criminal slander. There is a story that, temporarily insane by torture in 1938, he had cried out that he confessed his swilt of belonging to a criminal organization which goes by the name of the Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party, Bolsheviks. One of the charges against Ike is a trifle mysterious. He was accused of being responsible for certain resolutions of the Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party, Bolsheviks, and of the Council of People's Commissars. He pleaded that the resolutions in question were not made on my initiative and without my participation, and were in any case correct. Those made without his participation can only have been resolutions of the Council of People's Commissars, to which he did not belong until October 1937. The natural explanation would seem to be that the charge was a general one, made against a number of accused, some of whom had participated. Ike's letters to Stalin were ignored, though evidently kept on file. On February 2, 1940 he was finally brought before a court, where he withdrew his confessions and again attributed them to torture by the investigator, and was then shot. His wife was also executed. It is interesting, in view of the previous association of political and military executions, that Admiral Dushinov, commander of the Northern Fleet, former sailor on the Aurora, perished on 3 February, though on one in other ways inaccurate fictional account, he died in a labor camp. But these executions are chiefly remarkable as being included in a final settlement with the Yedrovites. The operation seems to have taken place in two phases, one around 26 and 27 of January, and the other around 2 to 4 of February. Frenovsky was shot on 3 of February, and NKVD veteran M.A. Trilisser, Soviet representative on the Executive Committee of the Comintern, under the pseudonym Moskvin, on 2 of February, together with Mikhail Kolstrov and the producer Meyerhold. Meyerhold's alleged accomplice in the writer's conspiracy, Isaac Babel, had been shot on 27 of January, charged in addition with links with Yazhov. We now learn that several veteran NKVD men, I. M. Kedrov, L. I. Rakhman, and V. P. Golubov, were shot on 25 to 27 of January, while others, like Ushakov and Nikolai Thwit, are also given as shot in January 1940, so they preceded their victim Ik to the grave, if only by days and as part of the same alleged conspiracy. Some recent Soviet sources give April 1, 1940 as Yazhov's death date, but a more authoritative statement says January 1940, so this set of killings seems to mark Stalin's final winding up of the Yazhovshchina. None of those liquidated at this time could be considered as anything resembling an alternative political leadership to which the party or the country might have turned in a crisis of the regime. In fact, few figures of any repute still survived. Bubnov had been shot, or died in prison, on January 12, 1940. Trademark, his daughter Valya was sent to labor camp, and the last leading figure of the Stalinist cadres to go is Antipov, who, presumably having been the token non-death sentence in one of the earlier mass killings, was liquidated in Stalin's elimination during the first German advance of all former such cadres remaining. Stalin's victory on the political front had been complete. Now, in the disaster arising from his own miscalculation, no move to replace him was possible. Subjected to this very severe test, the purge proved to have accomplished its object. Book 3. Aftermath. Hope once crushed, less quick to spring again. Matthew Arnold. 15. Heritage of Terror. None of the evils which totalitarianism claims to remedy is worse than totalitarianism itself. Albert Camus. Zakto, why? The last words of Yakov Livshits, old Bolshevik and deputy people's commissar, as he awaited execution on January 30, 1937, got no answer. During the few remaining months that old party members were still at liberty and able, occasionally at least, to talk of such things, his question was much repeated. If experienced politicians felt baffled, the man in the street was even more uncomprehending. I asked myself and others, why, what for? No one could give me an answer. As for victims, the first words on entering a cell were almost always, we are told, a shaken but why, why? The prison and camp literature tells of the same phrase, why? Often found written on cell walls, and carved into the sides of prison wagons and on the planks of the transit camps. The old partisan Dubovoy, whose long white beard, of which he was very proud, the examining magistrate had torn out, even developed in jail the theory that the purge was the result of an increase in the number of sunspots. The simplest form of true answer would, of course, be to destroy or disorganize all possible sources of opposition to Stalin's progress to absolute rule. But we can also see, in the system he created after his victory, the specific form of despotism for which he had sacrificed the nation and party. The victory was inevitably marked by a good deal of dislocation, and stability had not been achieved when the Soviet Union was faced with international emergencies, starting with the Finnish War of 1939 to 1940, which became a desperate struggle for mere existence in the four-year war with the Nazis from 1941 to 1945, and its of reconstruction. It was not until 1947 to 1948 that the Stalinist state became politically and institutionally stabilized. But meanwhile, two main objects had already been accomplished. A vast number of past or potential hostile elements had been destroyed or sent to labor camps, and the rest of the population reduced to the most complete silence and obedience. And, on the other hand, the Communist Party itself had been turned into something entirely new. This political transformation is to some extent masked by the fact that the organizational forms remained the same. But, in fact, the discontinuity between the party of 1934 and the party of 1939 was radical. The people opposed to Stalin had already been almost entirely eliminated from the leading organs of the party. Over the purge period, the Stalinists themselves, except for a small and peculiar personal following, were destroyed. The extent of the discontinuity is plain if we consider the delegates to the 17th and 18th Congresses. As we have seen, and it is worth repeating, less than 2% of the rank-and-file delegates of 1934 held their positions in 1939. The Communist Party of 1939 was more different from that of 1934 than Buchanan's Democratic Party was from Andrew Jackson's. If the latter case is more evident to historians, it is partly because, in the communist case, emphasis on the continuous tradition, and thus concealment of the change, were of much greater political importance to the rulers. The earlier leaders had wished to reserve all political rights for the limited leading membership of the old party. Stalin, in destroying that party, in a sense threw the positions of power open. He instituted the Carrière Verte talents in place of the old system. It is true that the talents required were of a special type. But at least any man, whatever his origins and however recently he had joined the party, could be sure of a good post if he exhibited adequate servility and ruthlessness. But at the same time, among the new cadres of Stalinism, party theory in its old justificatory form was still to be a basis. As Hitler had remarked, any violence which does not spring from a firm spiritual base, will be wavering and uncertain. It lacks the stability which can only rest in a fanatical outlook. A close student of, and victim of, the purge acutely analyzes the thoughts of the truly orthodox among Stalin's operatives. Taking the case of a former NKVD officer known for his brutality, but gentle and even sentimental when himself a prisoner, he concludes. What would a Prigov say if he were required to defend himself in a court of law? He would not, we believe, refer to superior orders, but to the teachings of Marxism and Leninism as he understood them. Prigov was as loyal and obedient as an SS man. But his faith was founded on a conviction that it fully accorded with the demands of reason and conscience. He was fully convinced that his was no blind faith, but was founded on science and logic. He was brutal because the general line required him to be brutal. The general line, so long as it accorded with the fundamental tenets of Marxism, was everything to him. Without the allegedly scientific foundation of the general line, which was the backbone of his faith, all the instructions of the petty authorities would have lost their significance for him. He was convinced of the logical and ethical correctness of his Marxist principles, and on this conviction his faith depended. For the Stalinist party maintained, in theory, the old doctrine and the old loyalty. But the discipline which had hitherto been due, in theory at least, to a corporate collective leadership now became the service of one man and his personal decisions. The loyalties and solidarities which had bound the membership now worked in one direction only, upward, sideways, as regards the party comrades among whom there had subsisted some degree of common trust, only mutual suspicion and vigilance remained. A new political system had been established. Not merely had the new men everywhere taken the place of the veteran cadres, but they had been given a long, severe, and testing exercise in the methods and attitudes of the new style of rule. The experience of the purge had hardened and tempered them, as the collectivization struggle and, before that, the civil war had tempered their predecessors. The alloy, however, was a new one. Dostoevsky remarks, "In the house of the dead, tyranny is a habit, it grows upon us, and in the long run, turns into a disease. The human being, member of society, is drowned forever in the tyrant, and it is practically impossible for him to regain human dignity, repentance and regeneration." A communist philosopher saw Stalin as the apex of a pyramid which widened gradually toward the base and was composed of many little Stalins. They, seen from above, were the objects and, seen from below, the creators and guardians of the cult of the personality. Without the regular and unchallenged functioning of this mechanism, the cult of the personality would have remained a subjective dream, a pathological fact, and would not have attained the social effectiveness which it exercised for decades. 7. At the apex, this led to an extravagant adulation of Stalin. A Congress delegate of 1939 remarked, "At that moment I saw our beloved father, Stalin, and I lost consciousness." The hurrahs resounded for a long time. And it was probably this noise which brought me to myself. And this was reasonably typical. A whole literature was devoted to the Vashd. In the country as a whole, a new public mood had been created. The experience had given the ruled as well as the rulers a new impress. The population had become habituated to silence and obedience, to fear and submission. In the years which remained of Stalin's rule after the purges, the all-out mass terror was no longer necessary. The machine had been started up, and could now be kept rolling without extraordinary efforts. It is true, in a sense, that the comparative calm which may reign in an autocracy following the elimination of all opponents or potential opponents is no less a manifestation of terror than the original killings, is, in fact, merely a product and consolidation of them, ubi solitudinem facient, pacem appellant. In any case, the security organs never cease to strike and strike brutally at all suspects. As late as 1940, Saratov jail was still holding 10 men in cells for one or two. Right through the period, Millions of prisoners, replacing the losses by death, were dispatched to the camps, and the threat remained ever present in all minds, yet the intensity of 1936 to 1938 was never reached again. In one vast operation, the country had been silenced and broken, and from then on more selective terror sufficed. This was partly because a good proportion of the new recruitment of forced laborers came from local and partial actions, starting with the Baltic and Eastern Poland, where the work of 1917 to 1939 in the